The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
They also spread the idea that jihad is cool, that you can be a hero, you can be larger than life. In addition, you have a number of people who stay in Afghanistan or nearby in Pakistan who effectively can't go home. They're wanted by their security services. They have, for whatever reason, are not able to return to a normal country. And they're somewhat professional jihadis, so they're looking for the next fight. So when Bosnia breaks out and you have a lot of killing of Muslims there, a lot of the people in Afghanistan, Pakistan have never heard of Bosnia, have no idea where it is or what the conflict's about, but it sounds familiar to them. You have Slavs, Christians who are killing Muslims, and they feel they can help. And so the idea was born and then vindicated by the fall of the Soviet Union, and that idea proved powerful, even though those involved themselves were actually not that important.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 6th, 2019. Benjamin Wittes sat down with Dan Byman, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center for Middle East Policy and Lawfare's foreign policy editor, to discuss his new book, Road Warriors, Foreign Fighters in the Armies of Jihad. Recent terrorist attacks perpetrated by foreign fighters of the Islamic State have highlighted the urgent need to address this phenomenon. In his book, Byman traces the history of the jihadist foreign fighter movement, beginning with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, through the wars in Chechnya and Bosnia, its role in terrorism throughout the 1990s, 9/11, and the wars since. The book also discusses how the U.S. and European nations have worked to counter the effects of this movement, and how states might combat the problem of foreign fighters moving forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 432. Dan Byman on Road Warriors, Foreign Fighters in the Armies of Jihad.
Let's start with the definition of a road warrior or a foreign fighter. At one level, it seems kind of obvious. And then the more you think about it, the less obvious it becomes. So this is a book about jihadist foreign fighters. And the first question I want to talk about is, like, what is a foreign fighter?
Well, let me start with my definition and then let me put some complexity around that. So I see a foreign fighter as an individual who travels to another country to participate in a war there. Now, that individual, usually a he, is doing it out of conviction rather than for money. So that distinguishes that person from a mercenary, but at the same time, that person may actually be paid, and part of the attraction of the war zone may be a better life. The Islamic State, for example, would offer people wives or sex slaves and cars and apartments. So there is a financial element at times. But also, I think very importantly, from their point of view, they're not foreign fighters. They're Muslims in this case who are joining other Muslims under attack. And so they see themselves as helping their compatriots. Their compatriots happen to be in another country, but they don't recognize the legitimacy of those boundary lines. And they say that we're a person of faith helping another person of faith in our community. The one area where my definition differs a bit from some others is I focus not just on fighting but on a wide range of forms of support. So an individual might go there and simply be part of a propaganda outlet. Individual might go there and be someone providing combat services, a doctor, for example. And all that I lump into the foreign fighter category, even though that person might never have picked up a rifle.
All right. So historically, if we think about, and you mentioned some of these examples, if we talk about foreign fighters in that definition, they would include George Orwell, Lord Byron. You don't mention these, but I think arguably it would include the Hessians who fought on the British side, although they were kind of mercenaries. It would include all the Zionist youth who went to help what became Israeli independence. So what makes the subject of foreign fighters today? I mean, obviously there's a specific sort of post 9/11 Taliban problem, but what makes the subject interesting now as opposed to any other time in history?
As you point out, this is a fairly time-honored tradition. And in the Israeli War of Independence, I talk about this a bit in my book, people like Vidal Sassoon or Dr. Ruth Westheimer, these were foreign fighters for Israel. And so we saw thousands of people in the past. International communism generated hundreds of thousands in different conflicts in total. But what makes this different is this concern about terrorism, is the concern that people are going overseas not just to fight but also to be trained to do violence in their home countries. So when people went abroad to fight in the Spanish Civil War, there wasn't a concern that they were going to bring violence home. Now, there was a concern about subversion. There was a concern that they were communist agents of influence as a result of their time in these struggles. But there wasn't a sense that something on Main Street or Wall Street was going to blow up because these individuals were allowed to return. And in particular, in the post-9/11 era, the Syrian civil war has generated these fears because of the huge numbers who have gone. We saw over 40,000 foreigners go to fight or otherwise participate in the Syrian civil war. And that's really a staggering number. That's a number that's greater than Afghanistan, Somalia, Bosnia, Iraq in 2003, all of those combined. So part of the concern is terrorism, but part of it is simply scale.
All right. So let's talk about scale, because I do think at some point that's a quantitative difference that becomes a qualitative difference. You know, the number of Americans or for that matter British people who went to fight in the Spanish Civil War was small enough to be a bit of an eccentricity, though a lot of kind of legend grew up around it. The Abraham Lincoln Brigade was not all that big, right? We're talking about tens of thousands of people here. What can we say about the demographics of foreign fighterism as a thing now?
The foreign fighter varies a lot by country. So for the most part, it's a young male. That's a commonality. There are a few women and there are a few older people, but it's generally men in their 20s is probably the median. Beyond that, though, there's a lot of variation. In some cases, it's been relatively educated, affluent people. And in other countries, it's been people who are much more on the margins of society. In the United States, with regard to Syria, almost half the people who have tried to go to Syria have been converts to Islam. So a huge number, disproportionate number of converts. In Europe, we've also seen a large number of converts, but we've seen many people who often had a criminal past or who were involved in legal but extreme Islamist movements, movements that wanted the imposition of Islamic law in Europe but argued that they could do so peacefully. So we do see some commonalities, but there's, I would say, in general, the variation is greater than what these people have in common.
All right. So the story of foreign fighters is actually a story that is pretty old at this point. I mean, you begin the narrative component of this book with Abdullah Azzam, who's, you know, in the 70s and 80s, right, and is this kind of inspirational figure in the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan. And you tell a kind of through-line story to the present day in which these jihadist movements are kind of inspiring people from around the world to show up. And that strikes me as not having a lot of analog in prior long periods of conflict, you know, particularly ones that transcend geographic boundaries. You know, Syria is not close to Afghanistan, and, you know, neither of them is close to Somalia. How intricately related, intimately and innately related is this to the phenomenon of jihadism?
If you go back to when this begins, the Afghanistan, the 1980s, Abdullah Azzam shows up and he's there with only a few dozen people. And as you'd expect in this, there are people who some are misfits, some are effectively exiles who are afraid of their own security services, unable to return. And he's trying to convince Muslims that they should care about Afghanistan. And the reaction of the vast majority of the Muslim world is, where is Afghanistan? It's a remote country we've really never heard of. For many Muslims in places like Saudi Arabia, they look at Afghanistan and say, the people here aren't really Muslims. They don't pray five times a day. They don't accept our rather austere Salafi version of Islam. In general, we don't recognize them as true Muslims, so we have no obligation to help them. And Azzam, along with several other clerics, starts to spread the idea that really that they're fallen Muslims who can be redeemed, that if good Muslims from the Arab world come, they can not only fight the communists, but they can show ordinary Afghans what true Islam is like and in so doing inspire them. What happens in Afghanistan is that the foreign fighters themselves are militarily marginal. Again, there really aren't too many of them, and most of them can't fight well at all. So they're brave, at least some of them are, some of them die, but they don't really matter much in the fight. But they think they do, right? When the Soviets withdraw, when eventually the Soviet Union collapses, they believe it's God's will and God was acting through them. So many of these people start to scatter and they show up in Algeria, they show up in Libya, they show up in Egypt, and they start to change movements there. They start to spread the idea that we're all one people, that jihad is an obligation rather than something that you can slough off on other people. And they also spread the idea that jihad is cool, that you can be a hero, you can be larger than life. In addition, you have a number of people who stay in Afghanistan or nearby in Pakistan who effectively can't go home. They're wanted by their security services. They have, for whatever reason, are not able to return to a normal country. And they're somewhat professional jihadis, so they're looking for the next fight. So when Bosnia breaks out and you have a lot of killing of Muslims there, a lot of the people in Afghanistan, Pakistan have never heard of Bosnia, have no idea where it is or what the conflict's about, but it sounds familiar to them. You have Slavs, Christians who are killing Muslims, and they feel they can help. And so the idea was born and then vindicated by the fall of the Soviet Union, and that idea proved powerful even though those involved themselves were actually not that important.
And of course, one thing leads to another because from their point of view, how do they understand what eventually happens in Bosnia, right? I mean, they prevent the genocide, right?
They look at Bosnia and they say by the time enough Arabs and other foreigners showed up, they were starting to defeat the Croats. And that's why in the end, whether it's Croatia, whether it's Serbia, that they are able to defeat Islam's enemies. And in fact, part of the reason the United States and others impose a peace is because that's about to be proven to the world, that there is a great betrayal going on. And this involves not only the enemy Serbia, but also Croatia, which was at times working with Bosnia, and secular Bosnian Muslims themselves. So they feel that they were winning, but that they were stabbed in the back. And there's a lot of bitterness still about Bosnia within this community.
Which is, of course, has echoes of a lot of other kind of stab in the back. We had victory. We couldn't be defeated on the battlefield, but there was a peace agreement that sort of screwed us. I mean, like all fanatical nationalisms, it has that kind of conspiratorial element, yeah?
There's a lot of conspiracy in this world. Right, they're trying to explain why foreigners are constantly at war with Islam. And from their point of view, it's a lot easier to say that there is a global conspiracy and that it involves the United States and Israel and Russia and India and local governments rather than it's actually a much more complex phenomena where sometimes these powers and countries are allied with one another, sometimes they're enemies. And so it's a much easier sale if they're telling a young recruit that all these enemies are one. And in fact, if you look at some of their training camps in Afghanistan, that's one of their big accomplishments, is when a young man goes to a training camp, he might be upset by Chechnya, say, which was the cause celeb of the jihadist movement in the late 90s. But when he got to the training camp, he would be indoctrinated and told that all these conflicts, all these struggles are really one big struggle. And that allowed groups like Al-Qaeda to redirect individuals, to say, you might have come for Chechnya, but you're still part of the war if you do terrorism against the United States. And that was one of their big successes, is taking individual causes and making them broader group causes.
All right. So then the next big struggle also involves Slavs and the Russians in particular, which is Chechnya. My impression of Chechnya is that it inspired a lot of Arab foreign fighters, and this Bosnia too, but not a lot of Western foreign fighters sort of showed up to fight the Russians in Chechnya. Is that right?
So Chechnya is unusual for a couple reasons. First of all, the Russians had cordoned off much of Chechnya, so it's really hard to get there. There's a moment, in fact, when Ayman Zawahiri, who's at the time primarily focused on his Egyptian group, is looking for a new base, having been kicked out of Sudan, for example. So he tries to go to Chechnya to see if it's going to be a base and is arrested by the Russians and held for several months. It's unclear if they realize exactly who he is or not. And so it's really hard to get into. And the second thing is that the local groups there don't want Arabs in large numbers, and especially if they're not skilled. So in contrast to the Islamic State 20 years later, who wants everyone and is willing to train them up, they want people with some degree of competence. So it's inspiring people, especially in the Arab world, but also Arabs in Europe who are going there, but most of them can't get there. So we get someone like Mohammed Atta, who's the plot leader of the 9/11 plots, and he goes to Afghanistan because he wants to go to Chechnya. He's hoping to train there. He's hoping that they'll help him get there. And again, you have this redirection. You have this group that says it's not just Chechnya, it's the United States. What's also unusual about Chechnya is that so many of the people who go there die. So we have an image of foreign fighters and Al-Qaeda that kind of come from the 9/11 experience and a lot of people going to Afghanistan in the 90s, where some of them do a bit of fighting, but really probably 95% of them survive. In Chechnya, it's flipped. Probably 90, 95% of them die. So it is a place that has a lot of respect and admiration within the jihadist community, but it's also a graveyard for them.
Yeah, it limits the influence.
Absolutely.
All right, so up through Chechnya, you see this pattern where the foreign fighters are predominantly Arabs from the Gulf, from Egypt, from North Africa. And then after 9/11, and particularly after the advent of the Islamic State, suddenly this changes and you have this incredible influx from Europe and to a lesser extent from North America. I noticed this in a big way, contrasting some of the numbers in your book with the numbers from my own research on Guantanamo, where, you know, Guantanamo is primarily an Arab population, or it's an Afghan population, you know, and then there are these oddballs. There's a bunch from Britain, but the numbers from Western countries is small compared to the number of Yemenis, the number of, you know, certainly the number of Afghans, the number of Saudis. You know, the pattern in that period, which is, you know, as late as the late 90s, early aughts, is recruiters from Al-Qaeda persuade young impressionable men in the Gulf and in Yemen, and Yemen is sort of a ground zero of this. Hey, we'll arrange your travel. It's a big thing. But it's not, you know, the number of John Walker Lins and Yasser Hamdis, and Hamdi is actually recruited from Saudi, not from the United States, right? It's tiny. By the time you're dealing with the Islamic State, you're dealing with an influx of European citizen Muslims to the Middle East, to the IS. And so my question is, What changed between 2000 and 2015 that this foreign fighter thing, which was, you know, a kind of Arab world, young men migrating to Afghanistan or to Chechnya or to Bosnia, becomes a mass thing among Europeans? What changes?
There are a number of things that start to happen. One of the biggest is after 9/11, European states start participating in wars linked to the United States. So there's European participation in Afghanistan. There's European participation in the Iraq War. And it's not massive participation from a government point of view, but it convinces parts of their population, the more radical parts, that any compact that they might have with the government, any sense of obligation they might have because they took a visa and thus had a covenant with the government, is now void because these governments are at war with Islam, that these governments are bombing Muslim countries and are otherwise at war. Also after 9/11, we saw these governments become much more aggressive on the counterterrorism side. So they began to arrest networks and otherwise disrupt them. And that was very effective on a day-to-day basis. But again, it convinced part of this community of hostility. But some of the big shifts are actually, if you will, somewhat prosaic. So if you look at Syria, for example, and compare it to Afghanistan or you compare it to Somalia, a part of what enables people to go to Syria is it's easy to get to. You simply wander over to Turkey and you cross the border. And part of it is also the existence of previous networks that were created during the Iraq War, that you start to have mobilization then, relatively small. But this enables much more rapid mobilization early on in the Syrian civil war. Also, the governments, for the most part, in 2012, 2013, with a few exceptions, were not paying a huge amount of attention to this. And in some cases, were secretly glad their citizens went. They saw a lot of these people as young criminals who were up to no good, and hopefully they go to the war zone and die. Right? There was a real sense that they were kind of getting rid of the trash by having these people go over as well. And then you started to see a network effect where people started to go because their friends and buddies were going. So once you had a critical mass, that critical mass became self-sustaining. And that's something that I worry about for the future, although I think this movement has been hit hard after the Syria conflict. I worry that there is still this kind of broader network, whether it's in immediate operational terms, but especially in terms of sentiment, where people kind of look at those who went with some degree of admiration, and 5 years, 15 years down the road, they'll be more likely to go as a result.
So you didn't mention two things that I was certain you were going to mention in the context of that story. One is the role of individual personalities, specifically Anwar al-Awlaki and Zarqawi and Baghdadi, these kind of very dramatic personalities that emphasized this come to us, you know, feature. But the second is social media and specifically the role of YouTube, and that there's something intoxicating to a certain group of people about these beheading videos and the sort of jihadist porn that the Islamic State in particular refined the theatricality of al-Qaeda to a very high art. I'm curious, are these overstated phenomena or had you just not gotten to them yet?
I think I can politely say I hadn't gotten to them yet. But what I would say on the personality side is that you have individuals, I would stress in particular Zarqawi, who, in contrast to bin Laden, Zarqawi, you know, I would call him a street thug. But his supporters would say he's a fighter, right? So there'd be respect for bin Laden, recognition that he had a life of privilege that he gave up to pick up a rifle. But Zarqawi was the guy with the gun leading from the front who was killing people, who was frankly badass, right? And that was very inspiring to young men where they wanted to be Zarqawi. And so that was inspiring. And you mentioned social media, and I think that was tremendously important, that you have the age of YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. You have a much greater degree for this community to rapidly mobilize and spread propaganda. and give instructions on how to get to a war zone. All the things that are important for recruitment and proselytizing were initially made easier by social media, and they've, I think, done a lot of good things in subsequent years to reduce that. But the first few years of the conflict was relative paradise for these groups to be able to recruit people and get them to the war zone. And the last thing I should have mentioned is the politics in Europe also got much nastier with regard to Muslims in the 15 years after 9/11. You started to have a lot more explicitly anti-Muslim sentiment. In France and other countries, you had veil bans, for example. And this created not only ill feeling, but it also mobilized Muslims. So you had groups and individuals that were much more likely to see the state in hostile terms, but also to act. And that was something that more radical groups could pick up on, and maybe they'd only get 5% or even 1% of those who were outraged and involved. But when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, that's actually a large number.
All right. So let's talk about numbers. So we have this trajectory of why it is getting more attractive. And what do the numbers look like? I mean, how many people were going to fight in Afghanistan under the Russians, against the Russians, against us? And how many people were going to the Islamic State to, build the new society?
So under the going to fight the Russians is a very small number initially. So we're talking dozens and then low hundreds. Ironically, it's not till the end of the decade when the Russians are clearly on their way out that you start to get much larger numbers. And part of that is because it looks like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan are being successful. There is a battle called Jaji where bin Laden himself fights, and it's relatively minor militarily, but it's a huge propaganda success. The Mujahideen basically hold their ground against a Russian assault, and this is inspiring to people around the world. Now, very importantly, later on the Mujahideen also fight, and they suffer military defeat after military defeat. And that defeat, of course, discredits the cause. It makes them look like fools. It makes them look wasteful.
These are the Arab Mujahideen.
I'm sorry, the Arab Mujahideen. Absolutely.
Not the Afghans.
That's right. And in fact, the Afghan Mujahideen think they're being stupid. They're just throwing away lives. And just to fast forward to the Islamic State for a moment, this is important for the Islamic State because part of the Islamic State's appeal was that it was successful. Right? They could legitimately say, we've accomplished more in a couple years in Syria than Al-Qaeda did in decades. We have a large territory. We have millions of people under our rule. We have hundreds of millions of dollars or more in our budget. And we're implementing Islamic law. We're the real thing. And it's hard to argue with success, right? That success is a form of propaganda all its own. And even though, of course, they're trying to paint the collapse of the caliphate as some sort of moral victory and it will endure, it's actually a huge blow to their recruitment. And what we've seen in other causes are in-between numbers. So we saw
– So wait. What do the numbers in – what do we know about how many people dropped their lives in countries around the world to go, go hang out with the Islamic State?
So it's probably over 40,000 people, 40,000 people not from Iraq and Syria. And of that, about 6,000 are from Europe. The U.S. numbers are actually relatively small. A couple hundred tried to go, and most of those were not successful. And then you have large numbers from North Africa, Saudi Arabia, very large numbers from the broader Caucasus region. They're often called Chechens, but most of them are actually probably from outside Chechnya in, Ingushetia, for example, or Dagestan. So it's really amazingly a global phenomenon, as we saw recently in Sri Lanka, which may have been touched by this as well. We saw all these regions have individuals who wanted to go to Syria to fight.
And for the governments who were pleased with the idea that their citizens might go there because they would get rid of undesirable elements and they'd get killed on the battlefield, of those 40,000 people, how many are a residual problem?
Probably very small numbers. So it's very hard to tell because a lot of people are arrested because they were foreign fighters. And that doesn't mean they would have committed a terrorist attack. The numbers we had in the pre-Syria era were that roughly 1 in 9 foreign fighter became involved with a terrorist group. And that's actually a relatively high number. And these foreign fighters were force multipliers. They made plots more likely to succeed, and they made them more lethal when they did succeed. The numbers for Syria seem to be closer to 1 in 300. And so that's a lot less. But since the numerator is a lot higher, since 40,000 is a much bigger number, you know, even dividing by 300 is still a relatively large number. But again, it can get hard to trick this out just because a lot of people come back and are arrested. And of course, a lot of people never come back at all.
And of the ones, do we have any sense of what the death rate was among them? So 40,000 people show up. How many? What's the denominator of the available to go home?
So a standard estimate is about 20%. It's probably higher than that because it's a lagging indicator. You have a lot of people who died in final battles, especially the more diehard members, or who were simply killed by local Kurdish or Iraqi forces and never accounted for. So I think 20 to 30% is a reasonable number for the percent that were killed on the battlefield or off the battlefield.
All right. So now we're looking at 70% roughly of the 70 to 80% roughly of the 40,000 people who went are available to come home, of whom about 1 in 300 are meaningfully associated with some terrorist group other than the Islamic State itself. There's a bunch of them that are in detention. How big a problem is this residual sort of foreign fighter cadre?
In my view, the residual problem is quite big but very amenable to policy intervention. So what made foreign fighters so dangerous in the past was they became these much more lethal tools that no one was paying attention to. However, after 9/11, there was much more focus on them. And intelligence services began to arrest them in large numbers, disrupt them in large numbers. And the simple act of leaving your country, traveling, going to a foreign war zone, traveling home, then returning makes you much more likely to be picked up on the radar screen. So in the pre-9/11 era, someone might go to Afghanistan and effectively enter a black hole. But now they go to Syria, they're much more likely to be detected by various forms of intelligence. And as a result, their communications might be monitored and reveal people back home. And when they go home, they're more likely to be either detained or monitored by security services. So they are more lethal, they are more radical, but they're also more detectable and thus in some ways a security risk.
So that would not be very comforting to me if I were French, because I would look at the Balaklan incident and I'd say, hey, Zarqawi starts as a street thug and a drug dealer, and he becomes an incredibly prolific, violent terrorist who takes the combined forces of, you know, U.S. Special Forces Command at the end of the day to deal with. And the movement that he started takes a few not even violent French street thugs and turns them into people who, you know, who can kill 100 people in Paris. And by the way, we don't even have control over, they're more detectable, but we're at the mercy of the Belgians to detect them. And the Belgians aren't that good at it. So even if we're really good at it, you know, we have these open borders. And so what's really the good news here? Is there any, or is everything that you're saying, yeah, on the one hand, they're more detectable, but they're really more lethal and we're actually not that good at detecting them, or at least we may be, but the amount of international cooperation with people who aren't that good at it mean that if you're, particularly if you're Europe, you've got a real problem on your hands.
Well, let's start with the good news. So if you're the United States, the foreign fighter problem has been a huge counterterrorism success, right? There are zero terrorist attacks linked to foreign fighters in the post 9/11 era in the United States. And that's really amazing, right?
Is it? Are you surprised by that?
Yes. I would have thought at least a few would have gotten through.
Before we move on from that, what do you attribute that to? Is that, it seems to me you could attribute that to the relative non-radicalism of the American Muslim population, the effectiveness of the FBI and other law enforcement entities, or dumb luck, individually or in some combination. What are the pieces of the success puzzle from your point of view?
That's a good list, and I would certainly put luck on this. But even if there had been one or two attacks, I'd still call this largely a success, right? If you go back to 2002, if you had told the Bush administration, you know, this is going to be the outcome, I think they would have opened champagne bottles, right? And even if you had said one or two might slip through, they would still be pretty pleased with the success given the very dire prognostications of the time. And part of it is the U.S. community is not particularly radical. And in addition, they cooperate with the FBI and law enforcement. So when individuals have gone, there have often been community members who have said, hey, someone won. Even if you look at domestic radicalization, you know, a failure, let's say Omar Mateen in the Pulse nightclub who killed 49 people, someone from the Florida Muslim community contacted the FBI and said, hey, there's something wrong with this guy. Also, there's no American broader radical network. So there's no Americans for Sharia law. Right? But there are Europeans.
There's just Americans against Muslims for Sharia law.
Exactly. Right. Thank goodness we've modified our state constitutions to stop that, right? And but there are plenty of European states that have large organizations of people who, you know, espouse a fairly radical creed even if it's not violent. So those are important differences. And then the FBI has been far more aggressive, right? So big shifts on the U.S. side.
All right. So that's the good news from an American point of view. What about the European point of view?
So if you look at foreign fighters since the experience in, you know, November 2015 in Paris, the subsequent attacks in Brussels by the same network, again, the foreign fighter problems have been very, very low in Europe. So you had horrific attacks. And then you want to go back in time, you know, horrific – the worst attacks in Europe – before by Al-Qaeda in Spain and then the United Kingdom also had foreign fighter linkages. So really bad problems, but in historic comparison, not off the charts in Europe. And part of it is they've gotten better for all their problems. So you mentioned Belgium. Belgium was an utter disaster from a counterterrorism point of view in 2012, 2013. Really not paying attention to people leaving. Security services were small. They were overwhelmed. They lacked expertise. They've passed much more aggressive laws. They've resourced their security services. They've improved their intelligence sharing. I don't want to make it sound perfect, but it's a step up. And we see this across Europe where the European states have become much more aggressive, especially since the Paris attacks, where it was a wake-up call. So it's not as if they've gone from disaster to brilliance, but they were not doing so well in 2012, 2013. Now they're much more aggressive.
And if you are in Europe, and you're a returned foreign fighter who's up to no good, and you're moving within the, you know, Schengen zone, how good is the law enforcement cooperation between states so that people are actually likely to know where you are?
It's mixed. We have a lot of cases where someone's been on a watch list and they've been arrested in a different country and then let go 2 days later because no one bothered to consult the watch list. We have still have some disputes about who should be on these lists and how they should be enforced. But that said, much better than in the past. So I would see it in relative terms rather than absolute terms. But also, when you have to move countries, you often have to communicate. So you're vulnerable to disruption in a different sense. You might have to work with a cell in a different country, with a network in a different country. And that means more people know about the plot and there are more opportunities for disruption. So although individuals are mobile, they're also more vulnerable when they start to leave their immediate neighborhoods.
All right. I want to talk about one of the reasons that I think we've been lucky, which is that some of our most energetic and serious people left the United States and didn't come back. I'm thinking particularly about Anwar al-Awlaki, right, who does not actually aspire to come back and commit terrorist attacks in the United States. He aspires to conduct them from overseas, but mostly he's an inspirational figure and a propagandist whose significance is less his operational terrorism, although that is certainly the basis for our targeting him. His bigger significance is the inspiration that he provides to people in an ongoing way, particularly in the English-speaking world. But he doesn't do that here, right? And in some ways, of course, he's not a foreign fighter in Yemen because that's where he's from, although he's, you know, kind of lived here as well. So how does he fit into this picture both as a kind of inspirational figure, and also but also as a model, right? Our people, we tend to send them over and they stay.
So Al-Awlaki is, someone called him the Pied Piper of Jihad, right? He's someone who really had the ability to attract other individuals to follow the music that he was playing. And what he was able to do was to translate a lot of the concepts into a much more colloquial English. So if you're an American or European listening to Zawahiri sermons and you don't, and your Arabic isn't good, it sounds very stilted. It sounds almost like a caricature. But you hear Al-Awlaki and it's a smooth, fluent voice that's very accessible. And to take others, Omar Hamami in Somalia, for example, was someone who wasn't quite as inspirational as Al-Awlaki, but he was someone who was very effective on Twitter. If you read his memoir, he's actually very funny, right? So he's someone
and
who
he had
can,
a great relationship with lots of members of the American press who all got really worried about it when he got in trouble.
He was someone who, you know, was able to engage reporters, right? And again, because he had this conversant ability with technology and with language. And so certainly some of the best Americans from a jihadist point of view have been these people who have been inspiring. But you also saw someone like Ali Mohammed, who was originally Egyptian, who comes to the United States and is effectively a double agent for Al-Qaeda and who plays a major role in helping Al-Qaeda even as he was working with the U.S. Special Forces community. So you do see occasional operators. But most of the Americans, part of it is they're simply not trained for violence. So they go there and they're not particularly effective fighters. And it's often hard for them to integrate into local units because they don't have good Arabic. And as a result, there are people who are, if they're going to make a contribution, it's going to be outside the fighting realm. So propaganda being an obvious place for them to be.
You talk in the book in the last chapter about what to do about foreign fighters. And you identify every stage of the process and what an intervention at each stage of the process looks like. So walk us through that. What aren't we doing collectively in the foreign fighter department that we should be doing?
So very briefly, if you think about this as a process, I think it's very helpful. So you have an individual who might get radicalized. Then he makes a decision to travel to a war zone. Traveling is in the war zone and trains and fights, travels back home and comes back home and plots a terrorist attack, recruits others, or otherwise is up to no good. And you could imagine at each stage doing policy steps to reduce the effectiveness of that individual. So one of the best, of course, is are there ways to try to get that individual not to go at all? So are there programs that can counter violent extremism, that can fight the ideology, that can decrease the militant presence on social media, that otherwise make the first step never happen at all? Transit is actually a very important part of this. One of the biggest things that hurts the Islamic State is that the terrorist group is pushed away from the borders of Turkey. And as a result, doesn't have access to Turkey, and Turkey itself is cracking down on networks there. So it becomes, starting in 2015, much harder to get there. And I mentioned Chechnya before, how the Russians block off Chechnya. If there are ways to reduce transit to a war zone, that's tremendously valuable. Once they're in the war zone, you actually have opportunities to do things. So, you know, you can affect the terrorist group and the people who join it, you know, 1 500-pound bomb at a time, right? You can kill people. You can force them underground. You can hurt their communication. But also you can identify people. You can find out through intelligence means who's there and who they know and what their contacts are back home. And that makes it much easier to deal with them when they do the return process. Again, you have an opportunity for disruption during travel. But also, if you are plugged into a community, you can detect people when they come home. You can know who the dangerous people are. You can also know that there might be some people who were truly disgusted by their experience abroad, who were shocked, who were psychologically traumatized. And those you might have different means of dealing with than those who are hardcore violent people eager to commit jihad on return.
Is this a problem on the wane? I mean, you described how the Islamic State had kind of lost a lot of its luster as a result of losing a lot of its territory and not being so quite so can-do anymore. Are we dealing with a situation now where the sort of heyday of the you know, let's pick up and pack a picnic basket and you know, and go to blank country for jihad is over, or are we just in a lull between the next, that this is now a sufficient feature of a certain culture of radicalism in you know, certain corners of the Muslim world, that this is just going to be a recurrent cycle and we're kind of between cycles of it now. What's the future of this?
So the hope is that this is – the Islamic State was unusual and that the steps taken have permanently reduced it. That, again, social media companies are more aggressive. Governments around the world are focused on this problem from an intelligence point of view and are more likely to stop fighters before they go and arrest them on return, and that you don't have a group in the world today as inspiring as the Islamic State was at its peak. The problem, though, is that the networks have grown and the ideas have grown. So the individuals who have participated in jihad, there are far more than there were 10, 20, 30 years ago, and those individuals can help the next generation. But also many of the ideas that the United States and other Western countries are at war with Islam, that sectarianism is a valid form of jihad, and that this is something admirable that young men should do, these are very powerful ideas and they have not been discredited. So I see it as a latent problem. It's not one that will necessarily come to pass, but it is one that is lurking in the background, and if governments aren't vigilant, could be a problem in the future.
The book is Road Warriors, Foreign Fighters in the Armies of Jihad. Dan Byman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Dan Byman for coming on the show. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.